Welcome to the Middle East Report, your connection to truthful reporting on Israel and the Middle East. I'm John Riley. Each week, we connect you to the people, places, and geography that you read about in the Bible. And of course, we keep you informed on the current events happening in Israel and the Middle East. And obviously, there's always a lot going on there in that region of the world. Today, I am so happy to be sitting across from my dear friend who I've known for quite a while now. In fact, I was just in his home last year, served a beautiful meal to my wife and I, and we enjoyed that together. And I'm talking about Jonathan Feldstein. He is the founder of Genesis 1-2-3. He was born and educated in the United States, so you're going to hear that accent. He immigrated to Israel in 2004. He is an Orthodox Jew, married, and a father of six beautiful children. He's the founder and president of Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation. His life has centered around building strong relationships between Jews and Christians, and he is a frequent writer for the Times of Israel, the Jerusalem Post, many other publications. We could take the rest of the broadcast to tell you about all those publications. His podcast, Inspiration from Zion, is heard by thousands. Jonathan, it is a joy to see you here in the good old United States.
It is a joy, and as you said, to be across the table from you, because too often we do this remotely, so it's really nice to get a hug on the way in and the way out.
That's right. Every time I see you, that's exactly what I'm going to wrap my arms around you, because I love you, brother, and my Jewish friend. You are the head of an incredible organization that has built these amazing bridges between Jews and Christians, Genesis 1-2-3, which really is Genesis 12:3, and that's in the Bible.
Correct. So we got the name from that verse, but it's hard to punctuate Genesis 12:3 foundation. So it's Genesis 1-2-3. Our purpose is to build bridges between Jews and Christians with Israel in ways that are new, unique, and meaningful. And we also, if you and I are old enough to remember the Jackson 5 and their song, ABC, easy as 1-2-3, I want to make blessing Israel as easy as 1-2-3. But a lot of, everyone knows the scripture, I will bless those who bless you, I will curse those who curse you. A lot of people, when I go to churches and I speak about it, I say, who knows how that verse concludes? It concludes with the text, the families of the world will be blessed through you. So it's the mandate. God is saying to Gentiles, specifically Christians, you need to bless Israel, right? I will bless those who bless you. But he's saying to me, to the Jewish people, you need to be a blessing to the families of the world. So we do embody that in what we do. From a year ago when a Tanzanian hostage's body was found, we sent a representative to the funeral in Tanzania and were a blessing to their family. 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, when there was a shortage of baby formula here in the United States, my first stop on a long trip was here in the Dallas area. And I brought with me 210 pounds of baby formula, Similac, with Hebrew writing that I gave out to two churches here in Israel that in Dallas, in order to be a blessing to them. And we try all these ways that it's not just about a transactional one-way relationship, but we have that one verse packs a lot of oomph, if you will, and it's a mandate to Christians specifically, Gentiles in general, but to us as the Jewish people. And that's the kind of spirit that we try to represent in the Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation.
You know, we could spend the rest of the broadcast and talk about how the Jewish people, the land of Israel, has literally blessed the world with technology and medical breakthroughs. And we could go on and on about all that the Jewish people have done for humanity. Well, we have so much to talk about here on the Middle East Report, and right away, I want to get into the situation that's happening right now in Israel, in Gaza. Of course, we know what happened on October 7th, 2023, the massacre of 1,200 innocent Jewish people, massacred, slaughtered by Hamas demonic terrorists that came across your border, the devastation, the displacement of the families that are traumatized as a result of what's happening there in Israel. I want you to kind of give us a little insight. How are the families doing in Israel right now in the midst of all of this? I mean, you've had Iran, bombing you guys. You've had Lebanon wars. You've had Yemen. It has been
a very, very difficult time.
The word you use is the correct word, trauma. I believe that most Israelis are existing in trauma, even though that we don't necessarily know it or think about it. But life has changed and won't go back and can't go back. And I see it through my own family. My son, we've talked about him. He was a newlywed on October 7th, married 3 months, called up on October 7th, spent the next 4 months in and out of combat in Gaza, which is then became the majority of his married life away from his wife. They hadn't even lived in their own apartment for a single night together until after October 7th and for months following. We see it in my grandchildren, who are the oldest three, who are 6, 4, and not quite 3 years old. We see the trauma in them, even though they don't realize what's going on, but they understand that when my son-in-law puts on his uniform and he's going into reserves, I don't know if they know what's going on. They hear, the older ones hear things in school from their friends who have older siblings, but they know that their father's going to be gone for a while. And they know, even if it's intuitive, they know that it's going to be extra stressful for their mother, for my daughter, being home alone with four little boys who are 6 and under. For us as parents and as grandparents, to be around, to see how our kids have been affected. We know indirectly people who have been kidnapped. It affects all of us across the state of Israel. And it's hard to say good news about that. But the good news about that is it's brought all of us together in a way, because we share, whether we're religious or secular, Jewish or Arab, we share a common enemy and we share a common destiny. So the trauma is deep. I think like the Yom Kippur affected, the war affected Israel for generations after 1973. This will affect us for generations. It is affecting us and will continue to do so.
So we have a new political landscape in the United States and the Trump administration. You know, he's in charge now. What's happening here in the United States? I want to get your response and your assessment of this new administration and how that affects Israel and what you think about it.
Well, it's a breath of fresh air to have people in the administration who aren't trying to twist our arms in Israel all the time, that we should be making concessions or that we are responsible for the massacre or the aftermath. But we know that the sole responsibility for that is on the doorstep of Hamas, this evil jihadi terror group. That it's refreshing on that level. It's refreshing to have a Secretary of State who isn't speaking out of both sides of his mouth. It's refreshing to have a vice president who isn't talking about the ridiculousness of the imperative get a deal done, which meant nothing. It's a nonsense phrase. It's a waste of oxygen even to say that, but that was her mantra. It's also fascinating to see President Trump speaking things that kick the door open on the whole notion of how there should be any kind of resolution in the Middle East of this situation that we're in, not for 10 years, not for 16 months, not for since 1967, but and not even since 1948 when Israel achieved independence, but now for more than 100 years. It's this jihadi ideology. And so when you have a president who's kicking the door down and posing ideas like that the U.S. should control Gaza and rebuild Gaza to become a Riviera, or that 1 million or 2 million Gazans should be relocated to other places, whether he meant temporarily or long term, it raises questions as to, well, why shouldn't they be allowed to leave if they want to leave? And why shouldn't other Arab states absorb them? If that's the case, then why shouldn't we look at actual real solutions, which is the project that we've been promoting very heavily for the last year, called SolutionForPeaceInGaza.com, which brings 100,000 Christians to Gaza to be responsible for the rebuild, not just physical, but spiritual.
You mentioned allowing the Palestinians, the Arabs in Gaza, to go if they want to. But the difficulty is many of the Arab nations don't want them to do that, and especially the Palestinian Authority, because they keep them there. It's like these poor Palestinians, and we can use that to just beat up Israel.
100%. You know that, John, and it's important that you and other Americans and people around the world know that that's the truism. Nobody wants the Palestinian Arabs. Now, by the way, legitimately, because they've been imbued with this jihadi ideology for 100 years. And Egypt and Jordan, which are the two countries that are adjacent, if you will, it will be destabilizing if you send 100,000, 500,000, a million Palestinian Arabs who are jihadis to both of these countries. So, of course, they don't want them. But you're 100% right, and this is the important thing to know, and most people don't know what you just said, that they're using the Palestinian Arabs situation in order simply to use it as leverage against Israel and the Jewish people, and that's a reality that everybody needs to know, that once you solve the problem with the Palestinian Arabs, you now no longer can blame Israel for all the ills of the Arab world, which they still do in Jordan, which they still do in Egypt. And these are their problems. So the Arab world needs to take on a bit of responsibility and, if you excuse the pun, their own come to Jesus moment, because they have to decide, are we really advocating for the well-being of the Palestinian Arabs? Or are we just looking to perpetuate this cycle of hate and blaming Israel?
You know, that's an amazing thing to think about. And as you're listening today, this is why we're doing the show, to bring out the truth, you know, of what's happening there, especially in Gaza. And, you know, I want to talk just a moment about the release of the hostages, you know, from Gaza. It's absolutely horrific the way this demonic entity, Hamas, is doing this, parading them across a stage, propaganda, and of course, a while back we had some hostages that were released. They looked like they had just come out from the Holocaust. Tell us, you know, about that and just the overview of how they're releasing these hostages and how horrific it is.
You think that they can't get any more inhuman than they are in this process, parading them out, using the Red Cross as willing, useful idiots to sign a certificate of release and doing it on a public stage with thousands of Palestinian Arabs out there celebrating this. I mean, it really couldn't be more of an inhuman spectacle, but then they prove us wrong. And the release of the bodies, putting them in coffins, which would be appropriate. I was wondering if that would happen. But the bodies of Kfir and Ariel Bibas, who were 9 months and 4 years old, respectively, when they were kidnapped, they were slaughtered. They were strangled to death by their captors. Two beautiful redheaded boys who were strangled to death literally at the hands of their captors about a month after they were kidnapped. And forensics showed us that. But forensics showed us something else, that Hamas making the claim that they and their mother were killed in an Israeli airstrike. So what do we know? Forensics is very smart. It knows what happens to the human body at death, and it knows what happens to the human body after death. Their bodies were crushed in order to make it seem like they were killed in an Israeli airstrike. And they were supposed to be sent back to Israel, these little boys, in a box with their mother. But the body of what was supposed to have been their mother, Shiri Bibas, was not the body of Shiri Bibas at all, not connection to Israel, no Israeli hostages, no hostages at all. And you can tell even how decomposed a body may be that it's a woman's body. It was an anonymous Palestinian Arab woman that they did a little switcheroo and then said, oops. And a few days later, actually provided the correct body of Shiri Bibas. When they released the body of this anonymous woman, they put her in a coffin with a lock and didn't provide the proper key for the lock. Now, by the way, listeners have to know that all of the coffins that come back have to first go through a bomb detection process to make sure that there are no explosives that are going to kill the people who are opening the coffins to create more trauma. And that's a really sick thing. And we don't know what continued torture they're going to continue to do, John, but we know that they continue as their ideology to extract every possible way of torture, psychological trauma, not just on the families, but on all of us as Israelis.
That's why we need a solution for Gaza. I mean, that's why we need that. And I'm looking at what you're talking about, the horrific things that you just described, and I'm like, what is the solution?
Solutionforpeaceingaza.com. And I push back a little bit on me starting it. God's a funny creator, because why did he pick an Orthodox Israeli Jew for this true solution? But it's the only true solution. with credit to President Trump and the bold ideas that he put forth, whether it was a negotiating tactic or whatever it might be, he kicked the door open on opportunities to think of things outside of the rote two-state solution box, which should never happen in our lifetime. And I can make the case for why there could be a Palestinian state. I absolutely can make that case, but no longer, not in my lifetime. And so what God put on my heart is that what needs to happen, we're fighting an ideological enemy. We're fighting jihadis. Jihadis not who have been indoctrinated for 17 years since Hamas has been in control in Gaza. That would be manageable. Like the Nazis were in control in much of Europe for 13 or more years. And it was only 13 or so years in all of Nazi Europe, the havoc that they created in such a short time. We're talking about a century of Muslim Brotherhood ideology that dehumanizes Jews, as does some of the Quran. I don't want to draw too broad a stroke over the Quran and Islam. I don't know enough about the Quran and Islam, but I know that there are sections of the Quran that are quite anti-Semitic and quite violent as it relates to Jews and Christians. Having said that, the solution for peace is to change the ideology. The solution for peace is to change their hearts. Without that, even if President Trump is right, if we move 100,000 or 1 million or 2 million Gazans, you've just shuffled the deck. You haven't changed the actual root of why we don't have peace. If the U.S. were to come into control, or the United Arab Emirates, or the Saudis, or the Palestinian Authority, God forbid, or Egypt, and we can go, or the Jamaican bobsled team. If they were to come in and control Gaza, that would be lovely. That would be fine. But again, you don't change the underlying root of the problem, which is jihadi. So what? How are we going to change that? We're going to send 100,000 Christians into Gaza to be responsible for the rebuild. Physical, schools, education, medical situations, nutrition, anything that you and I and everyone listening cherish and take for granted in a Western society that needs to be infused for whoever's left, however many stay, they need a positive rebuild and they need a spiritual rebuild. They need to realize that their God, who they call Allah, has failed them, that everything about jihadi Islam has failed them, and that there is a God, the true God, the only God, not a false God. He's the creator. He's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he has a covenant with the Jewish people. And our relationship with the land of Israel. And we are not the cause of their problems, but we are the cornerstone of the solution. And that needs to be a loving message that's delivered by Christians who work alongside the Gazans, shoulder to shoulder, doing the heavy work, but bringing a loving message of Jesus. It's not my job as an Orthodox Israeli Jew. I don't believe that they will receive that from me. But I believe that Gazans and the Arab world in general can receive that because at least they revere and respect Jesus as a prophet. Why shouldn't Gazans get that positive message? I'm not talking overtly about evangelizing all the Gazans. I'm just saying that they've never been exposed to a loving God, a God who wants them to succeed as much and be prosperous as much as he wants you and me and all of Israel. But Israel has a special place in God's heart, and the Gazans need to know that. And the vehicle through which to transmit that message is Christians going in, and people can check it out at solutionforpeaceingaza.com. And please God, in the next months, we will have traction to this plan and people can be part of it.
Solutionforpeaceingaza.com. I encourage you to check that out. You can join Jonathan. You can pray for Jonathan, because as you're listening, you're thinking, this is very, very bold. And some people are like, well, this is just impossible. Nothing is impossible with God. God can move in this vision that you have, this idea that you have, and do what needs to be done, because something has to radically change in Gaza with everything that we've been talking about.
Let me just say one more thing. I'm a very reluctant poster child for this program. God called me to do it. He downloaded the idea to me, and I understand my role as an Orthodox Israeli Jew and a settler, I say in quotes, the pejorative word, because people assume that I have a negative attitude toward our Palestinian Arab neighbors, and I don't. I want peace. I want real peace. I want peace with our neighbors and prosperity for our neighbors more than those yelling on the streets, free, free Palestine. And this is the only solution. But it's not my idea. It's God's idea. He downloaded it to me. We need partners to join.
There's lots of ways for you to be involved. SolutionForPeaceInGaza.com. Now, the main website of Jonathan Feldstein is Genesis123.co. There's so many ways for you to get involved and to join with Jonathan and what he's doing there in the land of Israel. He's bridging this gap between Jews and Christians in so many different ways. Something that we want to talk about, and that is the Root and Branches Partnership Volunteer Opportunities for People. This is another way for people to get involved with what's happening. Can you just sum that up for us?
This is one of the most remarkable projects that I've had the privilege of organizing. I give credit to my friend and partner in this, Marzi Amirizadeh. She is an Iranian-born Christian, and she was sentenced to death for becoming a Christian in Iran. And when she and I met and got to know each other, she came up with the idea of bringing Christians to harvest olives in Gaza. We did that for the first time this past year. It is now a partnership between Genesis 123 and her nonprofit, New Persia, which has a tremendous vision for where Iran and Persia can and should go in the future. And I'll just leave people to check out her website, New Persia. We had an extraordinary experience bringing 18 Christians from across the U.S. to harvest olives. We harvested about 1,000 kilos, which produced an unbelievable about 80 liters of oil. And the intent is to sell the oil to create revenue to support projects in the Gaza border area where we harvested the olives to begin with. We are now finalizing plans to bring hopefully dozens, if not hundreds, of people to join us in October and November to be part of Root and Branch to really knock it out of the park. It's not just olive harvest. It's not just tourism, but it's personal interaction. But people who are interested can be in touch again at our website, genesis123.co. We have another website, rootandbranchisrael.com. We're building relations through the root, which is us, the Jewish people, and the branch, which is you, the Gentile Christians.
This is another opportunity for you to be involved with what's happening there in the land of Israel in a practical way. You can actually touch the land. You can be a part of the land. You can be there with the Jewish people, and you can see the land at the same time. So I just want to encourage everybody who's listening to consider this. It's volunteer. Go be a part of this amazing movement, Root and Branches, this partnership, these volunteer opportunities. All these details you can get from Genesis123.co. There's opportunities for you to bless the land of Israel. And in return, you're going to come away like, I came there to bless Israel, but man, I'm blessed. You know, I'm like, wow, this is amazing. May the Lord continue to bless you and keep you and your family and all of Israel with protection over the entire land of Israel. And we just continue to pray for everything that's going on there in the land and your organization as well. Thank you for all that you're doing.
Thank you for always giving me the opportunity to share. God bless, John.
You can connect with Jonathan Feldstein when you visit solutionsforpeaceingaza.com. That's solutionsforpeaceingaza.com. Check that website out. And talking about Gaza, I've got a good friend in Israel, Shani Ferguson. She is a part of the Maos organization, and she put together some Hebrew words of the day, and I wanted her to share this one. We've been talking about it today on the Middle East Report, Gaza.
Today, we are going to be discussing a very controversial word, one that you have likely heard on the news recently, and that is Gaza. In Hebrew, we pronounce it Aza. In Arabic, they pronounce it Gaza. So where did the term come from? When is Gaza first mentioned in the Bible? The first time Gaza is mentioned in the Bible is Genesis 10. Just after the flood, Noah's son Ham begets children, including Mitzrayim, which is Egypt, and Canaan, Canaan, where Abraham would eventually move his family. Somewhat ironically, the ancient word in Hebrew, Aza, comes from the root Ein, Zain, Zain, and its meaning, both in Hebrew and in Arabic, translates as stabbing or pricking. If you follow Gaza's history, it has been a thorn in the flesh of many peoples and empires, even before the original Philistines, who are said to have come from the island of Crete, notoriously conquered and settled there. In the 1947 partition plan, Gaza was designated as a part of the land that would form a country for Arabs living in the area, though they rejected it, and in the Israel Independence War, Gaza was occupied by Egypt. This is part of the reason why so many Arabs living in Gaza today are actually Egyptian in origin. In 1967, however, when Israel conquered it along with the Sinai Peninsula, Egypt only asked for the Sinai back. Perhaps they too were tired of dealing with this tumultuous strip of land. In the following decades, as it was now included inside of Israel's borders, Israelis began to settle in the desert lands of Gaza. There they developed methods and technology to grow magnificent produce and create jobs for local Arabs. All this ended in 2005. It was called the disengagement. Israel spent some $900 million uprooting a total of 1,700 Jewish families from Gaza. This included 70% of all of Israel's organic produce. Sadly, the Arab animosity in Gaza towards Israelis was such that none of the abandoned farms or homes were repurposed by Gazans for their own use. And most Gazans who worked on those farms lost their jobs. Except the few thousand who would receive work permits to come into Israel proper and work on Israeli farms. In 2006, Palestinian elections were held in the West Bank and in Gaza between Hamas and Fatah. Disagreements erupted between the two parties until in 2007, a bloody conflict exploded between Hamas and Fatah in what has become known as the Battle of Gaza. Hamas, the more extreme of the two groups, executed and expelled Fatah leaders from the Gaza Strip and then enforced strict Islamic practices that would include the murder of Christians. For decades, Gazans continued to cross the border daily into Israel to work until the permits were frozen following the attacks of October 7, 2023. So why do we pronounce the word Gaza in Hebrew as Gaza in Arabic or Gaza in English and other languages? The greatest influence for this pronunciation came while translating the Hebrew Bible into Greek, as the letter Ayin can be pronounced both Ayin and with the more guttural version of Rain, but spelled with a G. So call it Gaza or Gaza or Gaza. But know that though it was rare, there were short seasons throughout history in which Gaza flourished beautifully, but only when its inhabitants were willing to live in peace with their neighbors.
That wraps up this edition of the Middle East Report. Get a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcast. We are on all the major podcast platforms out there, Spotify, Google, Podbean, wherever you get your podcast. Just search for The Middle East Report. And of course, you can always go to AFR.net and download the podcast there. I want to encourage you to follow me and please share this program, share this podcast with your friends and family. That would be awesome. Thanks for listening. I'm John Riley.